Disclaimer: the views and opinions expressed by the participants in this show are not the views of AnimeNewsNetwork.com. Enjoy the show! From Orange County, California, I'm Zach Birchie. Welcome to AnCast. Had a little bit of a hiatus last week, mostly because all of my guests fell through at the last minute, but we're back this week with another staff call-out show, and joining me in the co-host chair for this first segment is returning champion and answer man himself, Brian Hansen. Hey, Brian.
What's up?
Oh, not a lot. How are you doing?
I'm all right. Enjoying a nice little, it finally got cold in Tucson. Literally overnight. Now it's about 50 degrees. It's freezing.
It gets, you know, people don't believe me when I tell them, but having grown up there, it gets so fucking cold in Arizona.
And it literally happens overnight. It went from being 80 degrees one day to being, yesterday it turned down to 60 and it went down to like 43 overnight.
It's the same here in Cal. It's the same here in Los Angeles. It was like high 90s on Saturday, and today's the first day in a while I haven't needed to turn the AC on, which sucks. God damn it! But I also hate the snow and hate, you know, winter in general. So that's why I live here. It's because of this. Have you seen any anime lately? Anything new?
Yeah, I did. I finally sat down and forced myself to endure panty and stocking and garter belt or whatever.
Oh yes. What did you think?
Oh my God. It is fucking dreadful.
Really? You hate it?
I hate it. I absolutely hated it. It was just pee-pee poo-poo, the show.
How much of it did you watch?
I watched 2 episodes, and that's it. I don't think I can stomach anymore.
Yeah. People really love it, though. I don't know what it is. I don't know if it's just a love for the director, the fact that it doesn't look like anime most of the time. I'm not sure why people are so into it. I really don't get it. Because the humor is so it's juvenile, but that I don't have a problem. I love a good dick joke. I love a good poop joke like anyone else. But there's nothing else to that show.
No, there really isn't. And, well, there is one really big thing, which is the art. The art is gorgeous, but it's sort of insulting to see, you know, all these just amazing, creatively gifted animators really doing something really clever and unique. And then just fucking it up by just making it it's not just that it's gross humor, it's that it's disgusting. You know, it's one thing to have a poop joke and a fart joke. It's another to have, like, streams of shit going onto a character's face for, you know, 5 minutes. Just horrible.
Well, in the first episode, it's like the, which one is the slutty one? Panty, where, like, that's her entire character is, I sure am a slut. Which is, I guess, supposed to be just fall on the floor hilarious, because that's the only joke that character seems to have. Like, I was watching this, I think it was the second part of the first episode, and I decided to just start counting how many times are they going to go to this well of she's a slut. And I think I counted like 15 jokes where that was the joke. It was a different sentence every time, but it was the same joke over and over and over and over again.
But it's not really much of a joke. She's just like, I sure like sex. You sure do. Yeah. You're a whore.
Yeah, pretty much. Which, I don't know. I mean, you know, and what really pisses me off is when people compare it to South Park.
Oh, no.
I hate
God, no.
Well, they do that with every cartoon that is supposedly edgy, that goes straight to the dick joke well and doesn't, you know, is completely just unsophisticated boner jokes for 22 minutes. There's like a group of people, oh, it's just like South Park or Family Guy. And it's like, no, it's not. Not at all. South Park is usually satire, usually sophisticated satire, occasionally Emmy Award-winning satire. This is not that.
South Park won a Peabody, too, if I remember right, didn't
yeah,
they?
Yeah, it did. I'm pretty sure it did.
I don't think Panty and Stocking and Garter Belt is going to win anything ever.
No, I don't think so. At the same time, like, I'm kind of glad it exists, and I hope that it's popular and that encourages, like, the thing I said about Panty Stocking was, like, this isn't for me, I'm not enjoying this, I don't think it's funny, like, it's not funny, it fails as a comedy, and therefore it fails as a show. However, I hope it's huge, I hope it's massively popular, I want that show to be a big success, specifically because it might encourage other anime studios to say, okay, fuck it, let's break out of this design prison we've been in for the last 10 years and try wacky, weird, wild stuff. Let's get creative.
Yeah, and that's the heartbreaking part for me, because the reason I sat down and finally watched it was because, you know, I was really excited when it was coming out, because I'm like, oh my God, this is a show, this is for me. They finally made a show for me. I wasn't too fond of Dead Leaves when that came out. But, you know, again, I was excited before it came out because I'm like, oh, they're trying all this really weird, wacky shit. It's really designy and just really creative and cool. And, you know, Dead Leaves is just an hour of extreme angles and bizarre weirdness that didn't mean anything, but it was kind of neat. But this is just even worse. I mean, my hope with this is that some Funimation will license it and they'll do a wacky dub that's actually funny. That might save it, you know? If it has even a shot of succeeding, I think that's pretty much where it needs to go.
My personal opinion on the Funimation funny dubs are, I don't think they've had a big success yet. But I think you're right, especially if they actually add comedy that is not of the one, you know, one joke or the other, either dick joke or poop joke, one of the two. If they add in something else, you know, I don't know, maybe you're right. But I think that show's major failing is obviously the writing. And I'm kind of surprised that that's where they went with it. I really am a little surprised. But at the same time, if you look at that guy's track record, I mean, Dead Leaves was mostly the same, like you were talking about, but it had the same sense of humor to it, for sure.
Yeah, well, I mean, and the thing is, I think in a way the South Park comparisons are sort of an apt comparison, because South Park is actually pretty huge in Japan, if I think. And I know, you know, Gainax stuck South Park references into Fooly Cooly, so I think, you know, it was kind of like their take on the bawdiness and the juvenile humor of South Park, but without any of the satire that actually got translated. So instead, all you get is just kind of really bowdlerized, pointless poop and fart jokes with no point or merit.
Yeah.
In the service of just gorgeous art direction, great design, it's heartbreaking to me, that show.
Well, I mean, it's definitely building a fan base. There are people who are rabid fans of that show. I mean, they got militant about it real quick, too, because I trashed it in our fall preview guide.
Well, you didn't really trash it. Like you said, it was just like, you're as you describe yourself, a comedy snob.
Yeah.
And so, you know, like, it's just not your kind of humor. But, I mean, you go with everyone else where you say this is, you know, gorgeous and pretty to watch. And just on that merit alone, it's at least worth a look.
Yeah.
Whether or not it tickles your funny bone is another thing. But, I mean, the sad thing is, I wish I could just be so unsophisticated and just turn off the side of my brain that begs for quality and just kind of let the gorgeous imagery wash over me. But I just can't do it. I don't know why.
Well, but, you know, at the same time, like, I was trying to reconcile this in my head, because I laugh every time on South Park when someone dies and they evacuate their bowels. I laugh every time. But they do it, like, three times a season.
Well, and this thing is, the South Park guys also know, they're trained comedians, and they know timing. They know how to time a gag and time a joke, whereas this is just sort of, like, full frontal, all-out assault on your senses.
Yeah.
Which, I mean, given the animation would work, it's just, you know, I've written some pretty disgusting plays. I think in the first one that I wrote, I graphically described what felching was. But I had to make sure that when I talked to the other actors, and we all were on the same page of, like, how do you deliver something like that to kind of get the impact of it, so it's not just something gross, you know? And just, I mean, a little bit of finesse along the same lines of where they were going with the art direction and all the other cool stuff they were thinking about would have really made it this show kind of more than what it is, which is much less than the sum of its parts.
Yeah, I think what I was hoping for was more along the lines of Fooly Cooly, where it's got the art style, it's definitely unique and different, and the story, I mean, it's not just a gag anime, it's got a serious story to it, and it's definitely a comedy, but they're going more for a story, not just gags. So, yeah, I don't know. Anyway, enough about panty and stocking. I actually went in the other direction, and Right Stuff sent along the first box set of Dirty Pair TV, which I never...
Oh, the Task guys will love you.
For the everyone who's listening that doesn't know, that is the college anime club that I belong to, along with Brian back in the day.
Represent.
And the old timers there would not stop talking about how fucking amazing Dirty Pair TV was, and oh, we wish we had copies of it, and well, this guy imported the Laserdisc. It was always held up as this shining example of, this is how cool and awesome anime can be, guys, like, this is the shit. But I never got
remember
to
sorry remember when we showed the Project Eden movie and maybe five people stayed for it?
Yeah. It always emptied the room. Anytime you put Dirty Pair on, everybody would get up and walk out. And I saw Project Eden, and I was, it was okay, you know.
I liked it a lot. I thought it was good.
I didn't think it was bad. It just, I didn't respond to it. I mean, this is the same problem that I run into where somebody insists that this is the most amazing thing that they've ever seen, and they talk about it and talk about it and talk about it, and you finally sit down and watch it, and you go, well, that was okay. It wasn't the most amazing thing, which is probably a juvenile response. But so I sat down and watched the first disc of the TV show, and I had the same response. It's kind of slow, and I don't really find their antics all that amusing. The 80s designs do not hold up. The chick with the short hair has a tragic character design. The fashion is all quite tragic as well. And I don't know, maybe it's just like the Girls with Guns thing. I've never been a huge fan of that. I understand that back in the day, people were starved for science fiction, and this was hard. You know, it was action comedy sci-fi, so it must have felt refreshing in 1988, but watching it now, I'm just like, this is a relic. It's something to be put on a shelf and passed by, and like, well, this started a genre. I think you could probably say Dirty Pair started a genre.
That was kind of my exact same reaction when I finally saw Bubblegum Crisis a couple of years ago.
Yep. Yeah. That's yeah. Exactly. I was thinking about that too. It's like, this is like Bubblegum Crisis, which is just so painfully 80s, and it just hasn't aged. At all. I mean, the music in Bubblegum Crisis is so embarrassing.
Oh, it just drives you up a wall.
But I mean, as a museum piece, I'm glad that Right Stuff put it out. The discs look very nice. They did a nice job restoring the show, and I'm sure that the show's hardcore fans, all 15 of them, will stroke their beards and cluck approvingly at this box set.
The sad thing is, they probably won't. I mean, when you get into the process of trying to serve that hardcore of a niche fan base, you sort of fight a losing battle, because there's going to be some little problem, like, oh, the nick on the spine is incorrectly labeled, I'm not going to pay full MSRP for this, this is a travesty.
Right Stuff does a good job. I mean, I haven't seen a lot of the complaining about their sets. I mean, they're realistic about what they can afford to spend money on a dub for, which is pretty much nothing.
Yeah,
and it would have cost too much money to dub this, and they would have lost their shirts. But the box set is nice. They included a bunch of extras. I mean, that old timer crowd is, you know, increasingly shrinking, and so I think this will do okay for them, and so long as they, you know, didn't overproduce it. I don't know. I look at this and I wonder, like, how much of that 1980s stuff really actually holds up. And I had this conversation with Justin about Project Echo a little while ago, and it really is not that entertaining, especially this, because it feels like I've seen this a million times, and it's slow, and I don't care about these characters, and I hate that stupid cat thing that they have, that big, ugly, horribly designed sidekick thing. I don't even know what that thing's supposed to be, but it's hideous. It's a horrible sidekick. So anyway, Dirty Pair is out there if people want to see it. I think if I were to tell anyone to watch any Dirty Pair, I guess I would say Project Eden, because that's the best thing that franchise ever produced.
Yeah, which I don't think you can even get that anymore, right?
No, but, you know, there are ways. All this stuff is available somewhere. So the other thing I wanted to talk to you about, because you're an animation dork like me, the Oscars, we're getting into Oscar season here, and Funimation is making a run with Summer Wars. It's actually having a Oscar-qualifying theatrical release, you know, very briefly here in Los Angeles for about a week, just to qualify it and get it in the running. And I'm curious, the obvious answer to anyone who follows this stuff, does it have a shot at winning? No, not at all. I think it might have a shot at a nomination, though, if we get to 5 slots.
Yeah, that's actually what I was just going to mention. If there's 5 slots, then basically, I mean, looking at it right now, we know that if there's 3 nominations for Best Animated Feature, one is Toy Story 3, 2 is probably going to be the new Sylvain Chomet film that hasn't opened yet, The Illusionist.
Yeah,
it's played in a few festivals and gotten some rave reviews, and I'm totally stoked for that when that finally comes out. And 3 is going to be How to Train Your Dragon.
Yeah,
those three are locks. Those are not going anywhere. Those are staying put.
Yeah, those are the 3 slots that will absolutely happen. But this was sort of being dissected on the forums, and you have to get to, what, like 16 features in order to have 5 slots?
I think it's 12. And what's kind of saved it before is shitty movies like Yogi Bear and Alvin and the Chipmunks technically qualify as animated films, because 45% of their running time is shitty CGI characters running around. So.
Oh, yeah, you can put the Smurfs in there, too, and... yeah, the Owls of Gahool, which was a cartoon that I saw. It was not good. Did you see them?
No.
Oh, God. I saw it with Bamboo, and we were just sitting there the whole time throwing up our hands like, you're owls, stop doing this, you're birds, because the Animal Logic, they also did Happy Feet. They get into that weird uncanny valley with the animal characters where it looks too much like a real animal for you to take it as a cartoon character, but acts like a cartoon character. It's super weird. It's really hard to watch.
I don't owls fighting with swords. I'm sorry, talons or whatever. No.
No, they have metal claws that they make. There's an owl blacksmith. Hooter's gonna hoot. if it's those three, so those three are locked. So if there's five slots, there were two other major contenders for those other two slots, one of which was Megamind, which probably won't get a nomination. It was a hit at the box office as expected, but surprisingly not well received, that well received by critics. I think it's at like 60% on Rotten Tomatoes, which is not for a big animated movie like that. Usually those big animated, like the big DreamWorks, the big Pixar, usually hit like 80, 90 easily. And yeah. Megamind only did 60. I don't know if you saw it. I saw it. I thought it was really good, actually.
I saw Due Date instead.
Oh, well, I saw that too. Because I'm a dork that goes to the movies too often. But Megamind was actually really good. I really enjoyed it from beginning to end. And, you know, I enjoyed it as a movie. As much as I loved How to Train Your Dragon, Megamind was more entertaining. Just in terms of being funny and exciting and, you know, well-directed, well-written, real good pacing, good characters. It's a good movie. Solid movie. I'm surprised it didn't do better, but it's not going to get an Oscar nomination. And neither will Tangled, I don't think, which is a big development hell mess that Disney's dumping out next weekend. But
they're dumping it out with a lot of promotion, you know?
Like, there is, but
they've got their marketing machine in full effect on that one.
But it's a broad comedy.
It's
a real broad comedy. They're aiming it squarely at, a family-friendly comedy audience. So,
right, but I mean, Princess and the Frog got in last year with five nominations, and that wasn't terribly well-received either.
But that movie was sold as a glorious return to form for Disney's classic theatrical 2D animation. So
right.
it made it a shoo-in for the category just because it's this noble effort to bring back the glory days.
Right, but it was also, I mean, people thought either Ponyo or Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs were going to get in. And I mean, honestly, thinking about it, I think the number one reason that Funimation is kind of like, hey, what the hell, we can do this, is last year The Secret of Kells got a nomination. And that got a nomination because they did the same thing. They just put it in a qualifying run for a week. They took out, I think, one print ad and just kind of saw where it went. And luckily, people liked it, which, I don't know, have you seen that movie?
Secret of Kells, yeah, I enjoyed it. You could tell that it was made by several different studios because the animation quality changes throughout it. But it's a nice effort. It's beautiful visually.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's very sweet and charming in its own way. But it's not like it's not the big studio crowd pleasing powerhouse that the other two movies were. And everybody was so surprised when it came up. And everyone's like, what is that movie? What the hell? Nobody knows what that was. And but it got in. And I think Funimation's probably looking at that as a template. Like, if they can just kind of sneak it in, and Summer Wars is able to kind of capture that that kind of fervor just kind of offhand. Because the animation category is one of few where you literally have, if you're an Academy member and you want to vote in that category, you have to watch all the movies. You can't vote on the nominees unless you've seen all the qualifying films. And luckily, there's usually only between, 8 to 15 any given year. But, that's how Kells got in, just because of sheer dumb luck.
Yeah, it snuck in under the radar and sort of slid in when no one was looking. But at the same time, that year didn't have any other foreign, we didn't have a Triplets of Bevel or, any other foreign movies that would have even really qualified. I guess Ponyo, but Ponyo wasn't really all that well received by critics. So.
It was to a degree. It didn't win awards like Spirited Away did, you know?
Well, it also wasn't, the narrative was a mess.
Yeah.
So that might have had something to do with that. Everyone was like, all right, a new Miyazaki, what is this? So I don't think it quite captured the imaginations of the critics quite as well. But this year, I, in terms of just Summer Wars as a movie, I would love to see it get a nomination. It's a good movie. It's very well written. It will definitely feel totally fresh to an American audience, and it's particularly relevant because it's about, you know, the social networking phenomenon, and it's got big set pieces, and it is kind of a crowd pleaser as a movie. It's not too ponderous, it's not inaccessible. So I would love to see it get a nomination, and I think it honestly has a shot. I would put it if there's five slots, I would say Summer Wars has a good shot at that fifth slot. I don't even know what would go in the fourth slot, but
yeah, I think it does too. Although, I mean, the whole thing feels kind of bittersweet to me because I feel like The Girl Who Leapt Through Time had a much better chance of getting nominated when it came out. The problem is it was sitting on distributors for forever because Kadokawa probably wanted to get some big-ass Hollywood company to remake it for some retarded reason because they wanted money. But, I mean, that movie was so sweet and so charming and so right up voters' alleys that, I mean, that literally had a chance. But, you know, there just wasn't a precedent beyond Spirited Away at that point for anything kind of sneaking in the way that Secret of Kells did. Now that there has been that precedent set, you know, I'm happy for Funimation. I honestly do think Summer Wars has a chance to get nominated, I guess. The thing is, like, I don't know if the same serendipity is going to strike twice. I think if Funimation wants this to happen, they've got to put a little bit more effort into that. And, you know, that's really new territory for them.
Yeah, well, you know, getting involved in that game is expensive and time-consuming and difficult.
Variety ads are really expensive.
Yeah. Yeah, they are. But I wish them the best of luck, and I hope they get that plaque that, you know, which is as far as they're going to get. Because I'm honestly, like, in terms of what's going to win, I would right now put it at a toss-up between Dragons and Toy Story. I would kind of put it at a toss-up. People loved How to Train Your Dragon, and it was a huge success.
No, I'm with you there, but I think, there's some weird thing because people think that Toy Story 3 is going to be one of the best picture nominees this year because there was the 10 and Up got last year and blah, blah, blah. But, I mean, honestly, I think, if you're asking me right now, I think The Illusionist might be the one to kind of walk away with it because...
Do you think the votes might be split?
Well, not necessarily the vote's going to split. I just think I haven't seen it yet, but, Belville was, Triplets of Belville, the director's first film, was so just bizarre and funny and cool, and it was nominated for animated feature that year, and I think it won for best song, too. I know The Illusionist has not won any big film festival awards, but it's gotten some notice, and I think once it finally gets out there next month, people are really, really going to start paying attention to it and really taking it as a serious contender because it's kind of the diametric opposite of How to Train Your Dragon and Toy Story 3. It's just this very quiet, very, very sweet movie that's going to remind older Academy voters of the old French Jacques Tati comedies. And, I think that's going to be pretty powerful.
Yeah, no, I agree. I'm looking forward to seeing it myself. It's playing at the Los Angeles International Animation Festival next month. Actually, if you're in the Los Angeles area, listeners, the Cine Family is hosting the International Animation Festival, second year in a row, and they're showing Redline. So now's your chance to see Redline. Yeah, now's my chance to see Redline because I haven't seen it yet. So I'll be going.
Now I'd love to see the four-year consideration ad for Redline. That would be great.
You haven't seen that yet, right?
No.
Almost no one has, except for people in the UK where it keeps playing at various UK film festivals for some reason before we even get a shot at it. So Animation Film Festival, and they're showing The Illusionist, and they're showing a whole bunch of other stuff, including a Will Vinton retrospective, where they're showing that creepy Mark Twain movie. So if you want nightmares, check out the Will Vinton Mark Twain movie. All right, well, that's enough animation nerdery from us. Let's go ahead and get to the next guest. Okay, joining me now is a first-timer to the podcast, but longtime contributor to ANN, writes Right Turn Only and most of our manga reviews, and also does convention coverage for us, and is generally a jack-of-all-trades at ANN, Carlos Santos. Hey, Carlos, thanks for joining me.
Hi, Zach. Thanks for having me on.
Sure thing. So, rather than talk about manga, which you do sort of nonstop on the site...
Yeah, and then there's plenty of other manga experts out there who are better than me anyway, so...
Oh, I don't know about that.
Jason Thompson, for crying out loud.
Well, he's a special case. the thing I really wanted to talk to you about, you are a rare breed, because you are super fan, a genuine, honest-to-God... super fan of AKB48, among other Japanese idols. I mean, you're really into this stuff for reals. And I obviously sort of don't get it, But I'm curious.
I understand. There's plenty of people who don't. So, you know, it's definitely an acquired taste in that respect.
So what is that fan lifestyle like? What do you follow? How closely do you follow this stuff? Is there, I mean, where do you even start with this stuff?
Like, you know, a lot of people get into idol music with, you know, just J-pop in general. You know, one day you're listening to anime theme songs, and then the next thing you think, hey, you know, Japan makes lots of other pop music too. And then I started listening to that. And somewhere along the way, I got into the whole, you know, idol thing, which is kind of, it's an entire multimedia universe unto itself.
Right.
And, you know, to say that AKB48 is a pop group is kind of like saying Gundam is a giant robot anime. And yes, in one sense, that would be technically correct, but then you'd really be missing a lot of the other aspects of that fandom, that form of entertainment. You know, with AKB48, it's kind of like there's a ton of girls in this one group, and, you know, aside from just doing song and dance, they kind of they show up everywhere. You know, like you'll see them doing TV dramas, commercials, you know, in magazines and stuff. So it's like, it's kind of, you know, this self-contained universe full of energy and fun and life and, you know, that crazy Japanese-ness that you just don't see anywhere else.
So, I mean, okay, so is the idea here that you pick one or two of your favorite girls to follow? Or do you follow a big chunk of them, or do you follow everything AKB48 does? I mean, how do you break it down? Because it is nearly 50 girls, so that's a lot of
of
girls.
Yeah, I think you know, the approach for many is, you know, you eventually latch on to a favorite. I mean, for me, it's Minami Minagishi. He goes by the nickname Mi-chan, and you know, I kind of latch on to her because, you know, you start following the group and you say, oh, she's cute, you know, like, she has pretty eyes or whatever. And, you know, a lot of people are just drawn in by the surface traits, but as you follow the group, like, you know, they have a weekly TV show, for example, which is kind of this, you know, really goofy variety game show called AK Bingo. And, you know, you'll see certain members of the group, certain girls just kind of, you know, screwing around, having fun, making idiots of themselves and being picked on by the host a lot of the time. And eventually, you know, you'll latch onto one and say, you know, oh, her personality is really funny, or she's really cool, or, you know, just a certain charm like that. So, yeah, you know, you say latching onto a favorite member is, for a lot of the fans, it's, you know, the way that you really get hooked. And you support her and, you know, cheer for her whenever she's like, makes an appearance on screen or when she performs. But, you know, after a while, you actually start to learn who everyone else is as well and kind of just get into this whole hierarchy of, like, oh, she's my favorite, and then I like her, and then, you know, 3, 4, 5, and so on. And just, you know, it kind of evolves like that.
Now, okay, so are these personalities, the world of idols is often cast as being one of tremendous shallowness and sort of manufactured personalities. I think that's the way a lot of people look at it. Do you get the sense when you pick a favorite, are you reacting to it as though this is her real personality, or is it totally manufactured? Is it a put on?
You know, I think it's kind of it draws a little bit from how they are in real life, but yeah, they definitely put on kind of a character, a sort of, you know, other self when they present themselves as idols, you know, to the world. And I think, you know, nobody really thinks, oh, that's the real her. You know, I know what she's like in real life. I think everyone understands there's a bit of element of that fakeness, and you kind of just buy into that fiction. You know, it's kind of like just when you follow any, you know, Hollywood celebrities or something, you know. Let's say, you know, for years we thought Tom Cruise was this super cool, you know, super cool guy, you know, pretty guarded, but then he changed managers, and then, you know, found out he was a raging Scientologist, and he was kind of jumping on Oprah's couch and whatever. So, you know, kind of a strange analogy, but I think, you know, even the most serious of idol fans realize that it's all kind of a put on, but, you know, you kind of buy into her storyline, her character, and you follow her that way. So that's kind of how it works.
Well, it's really no different from American pop starlets at all. I mean, it's Taylor Swift is a total construct of the music industry, as is Miley Cyrus. I mean, these aren't yeah. real. I mean, surely they are real people, but you'll never see that. That's not part of their stage persona. And I guess my question is, the fan base for Taylor Swift is teenage girls, but the fan base for AKB48 seems like it's otaku. It's not little girls in Japan. Is that correct? Does it cross over?
3 years ago, you probably would have been correct, but you know, the recently they've just been growing in popularity to the point where it's kind of crossed over into the you know, general mainstream public. You know, you'll find random YouTube videos of like 5-6-year-old girls who are dancing along and mimicking AKB48's moves and whatever. But yeah, you know, I don't deny for a second that when the group was originally formed, you know, their base of operations is in Akihabara. That's like the geek capital of the world right there. So yeah, it was originally, you know, formed to draw in the geekiest of the geek, to have, you know, these you know, young adult males who kind of haven't money to blow on going to all the AKB stage shows and buying all their goods, because, you know, that's where the money's to be made. But as time has gone by, and especially just in the last couple of years or so, they've really broadened and kind of captured the attention of the general Japanese public.
So now they're getting more of a family audience.
Yeah, definitely. It's, you know, just a wide mainstream audience where you know, talk to a random person off the street in Japan, they've probably heard of them.
Is there any sense among the otaku fan base that's like a violation, like they're being invaded?
You know, I don't really sense that vibe at all. I think a lot of them are very happy to see the group just, you know, just skyrocketing in popularity right now. I mean, you might get your occasional stuck-up stop who says, oh, I liked them back in 2006 when they first started, and only 20 people came to their theater show. And, but I think that's just a minority right now. And really, the core fan base, so to speak, and the general audience fan base seem to be all enjoying the group's success right now just fine.
That's interesting. So the fandom by and large is sort of positive and accepting.
Yeah. You know, I think there's really no nerd rage going, you know, how dare normal people become interested in AKB48. I really haven't been sensing any of that, to be honest.
Right, but among idol fans, the nerd rage seems to happen when the idol steps outside of her stage persona for even a second.
Well, could you give me an example? Or, you know,
sure. Yeah. Well, like you, like when you see, what's her face? Was it Aya Hirano who just got screamed at by the fans for, I guess, admitting she had a boyfriend or something? I can't remember the exact.
The whole Aya Hirano madness. I remember that. Yeah.
Right, but that was all that seemed to come from the fact that her very carefully crafted stage image was shattered for a moment, and it was for something very trivial. But the fans just like started sending her death threats and stuff, right?
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I think we can't just generalize and say, "Oh, the fans," you know, all started raging.
Sure.
Again, it's the case of a very vocal minority, just who may, you know, may not have the strongest grip on reality, and they were used to Aya Hirano being one way, and then she actually switched management and tried to do a career shift, you know, going on those TV talk shows. And she mentioned the whole, you know, oh, I've seen other men and so on. And, you know, a couple of guys on the 2chan forums in Japan just, you know, started acting out. And somehow that's supposed to typify the entire fan base for her when, you know, even on that forum, a lot of other people were reacting, saying, what's wrong with these crazy fanboys who are raging about Aya Hirano? So
once again, it's an example of the extremists, a tiny vocal minority of extremists shaping the image of a fandom that is not largely understood by most people.
Yeah, exactly. You know, the media latched onto that. Two or three guys were, you know, trying to send or death threats to her, and they're like, Aya Hirano fanboys are crazy! War at 11.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know. That kind of sensationalism, because, you know, whenever I'll talk is crazy, hey, you know, the media just latches onto it, because, you know, they love painting those kinds of people in a negative light, you know.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
It may not be entirely true.
Okay, well, that's interesting, though. So it sounds like it's really unfair then to say that idol fans go nuts when they're, because that is definitely the generalization that's out there, that they demand these girls behave like they're perfect imaginary girlfriends, and then when they don't, it's death threat time. So that's really, you're saying that's just extremists. It's really not generally the case.
Yeah, that's right.
So
I mean, I personally think a lot of them probably have boyfriends on the side that they're just keeping secret from management. And it's really just, you know, the idol management, the company that says, you guys are not allowed to have boyfriends in the open, you know, because we might violate the crazy fanboys' fantasies. When really, you know, those crazy fanboys might constitute just, you know, a minute percentage, when everyone else would be like, if Atsuko Maeda from AKB48 is seeing another guy, personally, I would not be surprised. And I think a lot of people, you know, outside of that super hardcore base, probably just would not mind at all.
Well, and again, this is not unique at all to the world of Japanese idols. NSYNC, any of the boy bands from the late 90s, and currently to this day, are instructed by management not to have public relationships, because that shatters that shatters the fantasy of the screaming fangirls up in front. It's a choice to sell albums. It's not anything other than this commercial enterprise. So speaking of which, how expensive is it to be an AKB48 fan? Feel like you're really into it. How much can you spend? I mean, is it sky's the limit?
God. I don't know. Well, first you have to deal with the inflated prices of CDs in Japan.
Right.
The fact that a CD single cost 1,000 yen, which is like, I think, 12 to 15 US bucks now.
Yeah, 12 bucks.
And then a full album of, like, you know, 12 to 15 tracks is going to go for 3,000 yen. And then, that's about, like, 35 to 40 bucks here now. And, of course, there's also the special edition version of the album, which comes with an extra DVD. Or, you know, you get a little tchotchke, like a keychain or a sticker or something. And, you know, those are just the music releases. And then after that, of course, you have to get your favorite girls' calendar.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I got mine already, of course, you know. Pre-order starting October. And then, let's see, the posters. And then, of course, there's the photo books. Photo books are a very uniquely Japanese phenomenon in which you get these coffee table books of basically, you know, glamour and fashion photography of your favorite idol. And usually, like, hardcover and about, I don't know, about, like, 90 to 110 pages each, maybe a little less. And basically, it's just, they're selling these glossy coffee table photo books of, like, the girls wearing random outfits. And, of course, your obligatory swimsuit shots and all that. So you've got your, like, your music media, your CDs and albums, the posters and calendar, the photo books, and your cheesecake photography, and of course you can't forget the concert DVDs either. And of course, we all know Japanese DVDs are just ridiculously priced.
So it
just sucks out your wallet completely.
How big a collector are you? How much of this stuff do you buy?
I'm actually kind of selective. I have, you know, a few of the albums. I don't get all of the singles too much, because, you know, the singles will just suck it out of me.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, only getting a few tracks per CD is really not worth it for me.
Right.
But, you know, I think, like, as far as for me, it's really the visual stuff that takes up a lot of my spending. Hey, you know, I'm your average heterosexual male. I like looking at pretty girls.
Right.
So I've got a pretty heavy photo book collection. Plus, of course, I've got all the, you know, that occasional magazines that they appear in, because there's, you know, a couple of, like, Japanese magazines out there that are sort of the equivalent of Maxim, where, you know, they just have random content that adult males are interested in, and among that is, of course, cheesecake photography of pretty girls. And You know, if there's an AKB photo shoot and the latest weekly Young Jump, then of course we got to get that.
Mm-hmm. Right,
so
right.
That's, you know, that's kind of how a spending pattern runs, basically.
Okay, okay. Now, I know that, correct me if I'm wrong on this, but AKB48 splits itself up into, like, wardens or, like, troops, right?
They're teams.
Teams,
they're called,
okay.
Three teams of, like, Team A, Team K, and Team B. And they're each, you know, 16 members. So, you know, it divides evenly into the 48. And basically, they have the different team splits so that they can, like, put on a show at the Akihabara Theater every night, and they just kind of rotate which team is performing each night.
And so if you're a fan of one particular girl, you only attend her shows, or do you wind up, I mean, do you watch the other teams, or do you only just focus on the ones that you're, you know, that has your favorite girl in it?
Well, it's kind of like, if someone was paying for me to take a trip to Japan and go see an AKB show live, then I'd be like, yeah, I want to go see Team K because Michan is on it and, you know, I like her the most. But again, you know, when you reach to my level of immersion, you've probably, like, taken a number of other favorites on the other teams. So I'd say, like, I definitely wouldn't say no to any of the other teams' shows either, because I'd say, oh, she's my favorite on Team A, or, like, Mayu is my favorite on Team B, and so on. And basically, you know, for me personally, if there's, like, some contest that you're doing on TV where it's one of the teams versus the other team, like, they do occasional, like, sports, you know, like, ball games and whatever, I would root for Team K first. But, you know, that doesn't mean that I ignore the others. You know, I definitely follow each of them respectively as well.
Interesting. Interesting. Okay, so now when they came to the States, one of their appearances in the States, we sent you over there to New York. I think it was New York Anime Festival last year.
Right.
And I saw a video, and it's basically just, I mean, the songs are very cutesy, and they do choreographed dancing, and I thought that's pretty much all there was to it. It's like, all right, well, I've seen this a million times. Is there something special about AKB48 that sets it apart from the other groups? Because this is something that's been around for a while, the choreographed dancing. You know, what was that group, Under 17 or something like that? That they did sort of the same kind of choreographed dancing to cutesy pop songs. What is it?
Of course, you know, back in the day, Morning Musume was big and all that.
Yeah, exactly. What sets AKB48 apart? Because it does seem like it's broken out more than the others.
I think, you know, as far from a pure music and dance perspective, you know, same idol stuff you saw 10 years ago with Morning Musume, same idol stuff you saw 20 years ago with Onyanko Club and Speed. But I think really what makes the AKB48 concept right now so what's really made it catch on to the imaginations of the public is kind of the whole, well, there's a freaking ton of them. And because of the theater in Akihabara, you can go and see them almost any night of the week, which is very different from the traditional pop group model where, you know, they might do a tour once a season and, you know, you can only see them live for a couple of weeks, like in August, and then another couple of weeks again in November or whenever, which is pretty much how, like, Morning Musume used to, how a project is doing it. But with the AKB model, it's much more widespread and egalitarian. You say, I want to go to an AKB show, like, next week, you can actually go to one. Hmm. Kind of like that.
So it's more accessible.
Yeah, I guess in one sense.
In the sense that seeing them in person is not the rarest thing in the world.
Exactly. And in fact, you can even, you know, every time you will buy one of their singles, like, you'll get a free little ticket to go to one of their handshake events where you can just do a very brief meet and greet with your favorite member. Just, you know, pick a line for which of the members you want to go see and just wait to talk to her and just, you know, congratulate her and say, yeah, I really like your single, whatever. And, you know, they make themselves really approachable. And it boils down to that the whole motto that they were built under is idols you can meet, which is, you know, a big difference from kind of the pedestal and the glass case that previous idol groups might have, you know, placed themselves into.
Right. Interesting. Okay. Now, I was reading a story recently that there was this event where it was one of those meet and greets, and one of them, yeah, I guess, didn't have a line, or nobody really was there to see her, and so she sort of made a public show out of being very upset about it, and it was commented on that will actually make her more popular. Is that true? Is that the case? Are there girls where it's just like, okay, you're clearly junior varsity, you don't have a lot of fans. Do they eventually?
They actually made a whole production out of it on one of the other weekly AKB shows, where this particular member, Shizuka Oya, if I remember correctly, she didn't have a line, you know, lining up to handshake her, and she goes off and she actually just disappeared behind a curtain, kind of broke down in tears for a little bit, and because they dramatized that and put that on the weekly show that's being broadcast, on TV to the fans, and they see this and they say, "Gosh, I feel so bad for Shizuka. I can't believe that, can't believe no one's going to see her." So, it's part of that, building that fiction, building that character around an idol, and fans love to root for an underdog. And when you see like this girl is such an underdog that she couldn't even get a line to come and handshake with her, then absolutely, she's probably going to be having a lot more people come to see her, and they're probably going to shoot another episode in like next week's showing and show how maybe more people can see her. And in fact, she actually on the TV show where they were talking about it, she went out after that event and literally went campaigning out in the streets holding a giant sign saying, "Hi, my name is Shizuka Oya from AKB48, please support me." So yeah, it's all part of the whole dog and pony show, really.
Interesting. That's really fascinating. So briefly, actually, I did want to ask about this before we get to the next little thing here. The teams treated as like being like there's a varsity and a junior varsity? Are they all considered equal? Is there one that has the best girls in it? Is there one that's more popular? I mean, how does that work?
Well, not so much right now. I think back in the old days, of course, old days being meaning like 2006. Team A was the first one to be fully fleshed out with like the original set of auditions and just picking who's going to be in it. And then Team K came after that, and then Team B was the last one to be formed. So, all the Team A girls got popular first, but then they actually shook up the teams. I think fall of just last year. So back in fall of 2009, they kind of redistributed who's on which team, so that the popular girls would be more spread out. So nowadays, it's kind of like you can go to any of the team shows, and you'll probably see one of the ones who like appears in all the magazine photo shoots and gets the most FaceTime on the music videos. In fact, when you watch an AKB music video for one of their singles, they never actually have the entire all 48 of the mom there. You'll only see like the front 20 girls or so, and they would be known as like Tenbatsu, which means the chosen ones, literally. But there's like certain ones who are kind of veteran members or have a pretty strong fan base that they will always pick to be kind of the face of the group, so to speak, and you'll see them getting more time on the music videos and more magazine photo shoots and so on.
Wow, I wonder how rough a life that is, being a member of that group.
I would not want to live it. I mean, I would rather go through like the rigorous life of being a classical musician and practicing piano 12 hours a day than have to try to live with that kind of soul-crushing, it can be very difficult to live an idol life. I don't doubt that.
Yeah, I can't imagine. So the other thing I wanted to ask you about that you're a big fan of, that I also do not really understand, is the Vocaloid thing, Hatsune Miku. Now, this is this is, from what I understand, this is a fake idol. It's a CG character that is, is she, auto-tuned? How does this work?
Well, the technology behind Vocaloid kind of goes like this. It's like, synthesizer keyboards and electronic keyboards, basically, they record the sound of a musical instrument known as sampling, mm-hmm. and then they assign it to all the different pitches on a keyboard. So, if you play, you play a digital piano, you're not, you know, it's not a real piano. You press the key and you get a, you know, you're telling the computer to play the sound of a piano that was recorded for the note A or the note C or whatever, mm-hmm. right?
Right.
Okay? So basically they wanted to do this for the human voice, but the human voice being so expressive and so organic is very hard to do until just the last few years with Vocaloid technology, which basically they had an actual voice actress come in, record a number of syllables and pitches and sounds, and then develop the software system so that you could assign a particular note and a particular syllable from a computer message, and it would play that particular recording of that sample of that voice. So Vocaloid technology allows you to compose, pop music or any kind of music for a human voice without actually having to have a human there to sing it for you.
Okay, interesting. And so then they created these characters.
Mm-hmm.
And
the characters just really took off.
Right. So, you've been to one of these concerts. What is the concert like? Are you watching a screen? Is it a hologram or what is it?
It was not actually the concert itself. It was a recording of the concert that was shown, that was held in Japan back in March of this year. Basically, they created, a 3D CGI model of Miku.
Mm-hmm.
And then they projected her, the video footage of her onto this glass screen. Well, not glass, but a special kind of glass on the screen, and makes it look like she's really there, in 3D, but just a CGI image on the stage on this glass screen. And basically, she dances and sings her songs, and it looks like a real-life 3D anime character is right there singing for you.
Wow, interesting.
And
any idea what it costs to get into this thing? Like, are people paying crazy amounts to get in to see this, quote-unquote, in person?
I actually don't know how much the tickets were for the showing in Japan, to be honest. So, just for the screening, of the recording of the concert over in San Francisco, it was like we pretty much had a packed theater and the damn thing sold out. So it's like people are going here paying to see a recording of a recording, of all things. But hey, whatever floats your boat, and it floats my boat, why the hell not,
That's really interesting. Where, if somebody was interested in reading more about either of these subjects, is there a clearinghouse, like the best place to go for AKB48? Is there a best place to go for the Miku?
Oh my gosh. Let's see. Well, as far as for Vocaloids, I know there's a really cool site called Vocaloidism.com, just one word, Vocaloidism.com, which is kind of like a pretty big fan hub where you can find out, what a lot of songwriters and producers are up to, like with, making this electronic music with Vocaloids. And then as far as finding out more about AKB48, a lot of it is just, a lot of that fandom is very, very organic. There's a lot of, just online forums and communities. But the biggest one out there is called Stage 48. And that's kind of like just a giant hive where everyone comes in on and talks about AKB48. But to be honest, I kind of just lurk on Stage 48. I never actually participate there because being a big forum, there's also a lot of drama.
Mm.
Just saying.
Yep. Yeah. I can imagine.
And especially with the fans getting so passionate about the whole thing, Yeah.
Do they fight with each other over who's the best? I would imagine they do.
To some extent. I mean, a lot of it's just, friendly, saying, yeah, my girl's better than your girl, and just, friendly rivalry. But, a lot of the times when there's, something big happening, just some kind of big shakeup with the group, or, there's a new single coming out, and someone doesn't like how it sounds. Yeah, there can be a lot of infighting and arguing. So,
typical
internet.
Yeah.
I'm sure it doesn't surprise you at all.
No, not at all. But that's all very interesting, and thank you for that. That was very enlightening. It's so interesting to hear about the stuff. It's funny how it's connected to anime fandom, but it feels like a completely alien, totally other world.
Yeah, it kind of has, it's a different universe. They use different words for everything, but you know, the same passion of the fans is definitely there.
Awesome. Okay, man. Well, thank you. That was really enlightening. Thanks a lot.
No problem.
Okay, joining me next, author of The X Button, Todd Ciolek. Hey, man.
Hi, Zach. Glad to be here.
Thanks for coming on. We haven't had you on yet in any of our staff call-outs or any of our regular call-out shows. And, you know, all I had to do was mention him and have Todd on, and we're going to talk about video games on Twitter. And I got a ton of questions, so we'll get to those in a little bit. But how's it going? What have you been playing lately? What's on your radar?
Well, I just got, I think you pronounce it Guange for the Xbox 360. I was talking about that in the column. It's a cave shooter. It just came out on Xbox Live, actually. I've also been playing Costume Quest a little bit.
Right. Is that, that's the Double Fine one, right?
That's Double Fine. It's the Halloween-themed RPG.
Interesting. Any good?
Actually, it is. Cool. I'm surprised, too, because it is just a downloadable game. And when you get stuff off Live Arcade, you sometimes don't expect too much for your $10, but it's excellent, really.
Well, that's cool. So with these cave shooters, I noticed that they've been putting these out more regularly. Like, you can get them on, I cannot imagine playing one on an iPhone, but you can get them there. They've been putting them out on Xbox Live a lot, and I think PSN. And I noticed that there's, like, my local Fry's has a stack of the Death Smiles limited edition, which they can't give away because there's a huge pile of them sitting there.
That's what the one where the packaging, I think, really kind of killed the game's chances with anybody who's not already a big fan of, you know, half-naked model kits or something like that.
Yeah, well, what's the deal with these things? Do they sell? Are they popular? I mean, they keep putting them out.
Well, for those kinds of shooters, you really have two audiences that are buying them. First of all, of course, you have the MOE crowd. Right. They're buying them for the characters and to some extent for the gameplay. And then you have the hardcore shooter fans. These are the people who will actually go so far as to pay like $1,000 for an arcade board of like a new cave shooter as soon as it hits the Japanese scene.
Wow.
And they're basically buying it for the gameplay. They're going to sit there and memorize the game until they can finish it on like one credit.
Right.
And
right.
Most of them really don't care what kind of characters or what kind of atmosphere it has, as long as it's a decent shooter.
So they're just in it for the bullet hell, basically.
Yes. And I'd be interested in seeing how well Death Smiles sold, because that was really a test, I think, for Axis Games. They were going to see how well a hardcore shooter would do over here. And they haven't really announced any other shooters.
Yeah, well, I mean, I see that every time I go into a GameStop, there's at least one copy of it. And with limited editions like that, that's the sort of thing you shouldn't be seeing on the shelf. Although, I don't know, did they even do a standard edition, or did you have to buy the limited?
I believe it's a limited.
Yeah, no, I never got into those, mostly because I'm terrible at shooters. I remember spending many a day when I was a kid being incredibly frustrated by R-Type. But then again, I think that was everyone.
Oh, yeah. R-Type is really a memorizing shooter where you have to basically play it over and over until you get it right. And when you're a kid, you really have a lot of time to do that.
Yeah, no, I mean, I've got I bought R-Types when they put it out on Xbox Live because I had a buddy who's really into R-Type. And it had an online co-op. And we were playing. You can play through it on unlimited lives and unlimited continues to where you just never die. You can just blow through the entire game. And there are literally parts in that game where I can't figure out how to do it without dying. Even though I have an invincible ship playing through the game, it's like there's no way to do this without dying or dumping $10 worth of quarters into the machine. But I guess that means I'm not really a shooter player.
Yeah, you can always check out those YouTube videos of people who are playing through, you know, Gradius like 10 times in a row without ever taking a hit. And yeah. So it's really insane. A cult-like obsession with some shooters out there.
Yeah, so in terms of like other Japanese games out there, there's all this talk about how Japan is no longer the dominant force when it comes to video game creation.
Yeah,
and I think that's demonstrable. You could see that happening.
And really, Japan hasn't been the dominant force in video games for I would say at least 10 years now. I think the real sign that Japan wasn't dominant anymore came with the start of the PlayStation 2 era, where that you had Grand Theft Auto was the biggest thing anybody could talk about. And if you even go back into the 1990s, you can see how it was sort of sliding away from Japan. The industry was sort of going over to properties that were actually made in America. Even in the mid-90s, you had Earthworm Jim, you had Mortal Kombat, you had Donkey Kong Country, I guess, which was technically Nintendo, but Rare made it. So it's been a really gradual process, I think. And a lot of people, when they talk about this, they sort of use Final Fantasy and Japanese role-playing games as an example of a genre that's gone downhill. But the thing is, Japanese role-playing games have never been huge on the whole in America. it's really just been a Final Fantasy and Pokemon kind of deal.
Yeah.
Well, in a way, I think it's just this conception that Japan was the major player in the game industry for a while, just because you had Mario and Zelda and things like that that are still popular. And I think it's just gaming has really expanded in the past decade and done so mostly through Western properties, World of Warcraft, stuff like that.
Well, I think one of the things that happened is the big genre that, you know, in the PlayStation 2 era, what happened were shooters. Shooters suddenly became the genre. Like, if you want to make money, make a shooter. And that's only grown exponentially since then. I mean, Call of Duty Black Ops sold, what, 5.5 million copies in the U.S. and the U.K. in one day? Mm-hmm. That was just Tuesday sales.
And it was really Halo that started that, I think, because...
Yeah.
That was when people woke up and realized that you can make a shooter on a console without having it to go to the PC first.
And shooters have never been popular in Japan. Like, never.
Yeah.
It's just not a genre that they're really into. But at the same time, you know, JRPGs are also, you know, that's the big, I would assume that's the big genre over there besides, like, visual novels and stuff like that. But there hasn't been a big smash hit besides, like, Monster Hunter, which didn't hit here either. Besides Monster Hunter, there hasn't been a major sensation in terms of Japanese role-playing games in a while. I mean, Final Fantasy XIII was not well-received.
Yeah, to some extent, it's weird. The thing with any Final Fantasy is that no matter how, you know, no matter what the game is, even the worst game in the series, which I think is still Final Fantasy Mystic Quest or whatever, or Crystal Chronicles, someone will say it's their favorite game. So, because Final Fantasy fans are just kind of disparate like that.
Yeah, I mean, I hated Final Fantasy XIII, like, with a intense passion. That game made me so angry. Like, I've never been that furiously frustrated with a Final Fantasy game. And I hated 8, too. Like, I thought 8 was awful.
Yeah, I think 8 is really the game that 13 has the most in common with, just in terms of the reception. It's going to be one of those games where even the people who like it are going to say, well, you got to look past this or something like that.
You got to look past the first 20 hours of gameplay, which that is not an excuse. There's never an excuse for that. That is not like a thing. That's like saying the first 20 episodes of the show are terrible, but those last six, oh, man.
Exactly.
But you do hear that, though. So I don't know. In terms of Final Fantasy, do you have a favorite?
You know, it's hard to pin one down. I'd probably go with 6 or 12 on the numbered ones, but Tactics, I think, is my favorite.
Oh, yeah. Okay, right. You're one of those guys.
And that's kind of an easy answer because a lot of people consider that the best Final Fantasy because it's unlike all the other ones.
Yeah, I'm an odd man out because my favorite is 9.
9? Yeah.
Which does not have a lot of fans. I think it's because of the character design. There's no pretty boys. They're all sort of squash-looking cartoon characters. But I liked the gameplay on that one. It was a lot of fun.
9 is really notable, I think, for being one of the most coherent Final Fantasies. It doesn't really get off track. It doesn't devolve into a complete mess at any point, really. It basically is, of all the Final Fantasies, it's the one that knows the most what it wants to be, and I think it does it really well.
Yeah, I mean, it's got the same plot twist as 7.
Yeah, pretty much.
But here's a question. Why don't they sequelize these things faster? Because, you know, I know there's a new Final Fantasy every 2 or 3 years, but I noticed, like, with Kingdom Hearts, there's Kingdom Hearts 2, and then there's a million games that are like, oh, this takes place between the hours of 6 and 7 p.m. on a day in between Kingdom Hearts 1 and 2. I mean, why don't they just put out a fucking third one? And also, why haven't they remade Final Fantasy VII yet? Because that's the license to print money.
Yeah, that, as far as Final Fantasy VII goes, I really don't know why they haven't remade it, because you could basically just do that without changing any of the underlying gameplay. And fans would, of course, pay God knows how much for it. But with the Kingdom Hearts games, I think part of the problem is that, unlike, you know, Enix, you know, the Square Enix, but an Enix really has no problem with making, like, their flagship series, like Dragon Quest. They had no problem making Dragon Quest IX on the DS.
Yeah.
But Square is really reluctant for some reason to make its proper sequels on handheld systems. And a game for, like, the PlayStation 3, the Xbox 360 takes a lot more time and resources to make. So I think what Square is doing is they're filling in the gaps by making these, you know, Kingdom Hearts and Final Fantasy games that are, you know, side stories on the DS and the PSP, because someone, I guess, high up in the company just doesn't want to put an actual Final Fantasy 15 on the, like, DS.
Which is where it'll make the most money.
Yeah. And to be honest, I wouldn't be surprised if that changes in the future, just because of, well, what happened with Final Fantasy 14 and with 13.
Yeah, 14, we talk 14 about 14? Is a giant mess.
Have you even really scrambling to fix that one up?
Have you even set foot in that thing?
No, it's I'm kind of waiting to see what they're going to do with the console version.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, I walked into a store and there it was sitting. There was like a, they had a table out with all the new releases and there was Final Fantasy 14. And I'm like, holy shit, they put that out already? Like, there's no way this game is ready. And then I go online and they're like, wow, this is a giant broken clusterfuck. Yeah. Like, wow, why did they put this shit out?
Yeah, so if it keeps going that way, I wouldn't be surprised if, you know, Final Fantasy 16 is a 3DS game or something.
Yeah, or I would say it's probably a better bet on the PSP, just because PSP games are licensed. They just make huge amounts of money in Japan. You know, that's where that's why there's like a bunch of Kingdom Hearts games now, and that's where they put that fighting game, which I haven't touched.
Dissidia, yes.
Yeah. Are those any good? Have you tried that?
It's actually not too bad. The first one, it's kind of shallow, but you also have a lot more to do than you normally do in a typical fighting game, because you get to run around a huge arena and explore these sort of RPG-esque features, like customizing your character in the story mode.
Right. Yeah.
So it's really not bad, but it's a total cash-in. And what really bothered me about the first one is that they kind of ignored the more interesting Final Fantasy characters, and they went with all the completely forgettable characters from like the first three Final Fantasies, which, you know, barely had plots.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah.
But yeah, you know, it's
that's interesting. So, do you think Japanese developers should start mimicking Western style development? I mean, should we start getting, you know, Fallout alikes from Japan? Is that even gonna? Do you think they're gonna go the way of the Western RPG or the shooter?
Well, when Japan tried to go the way of the Western shooter, we ended up with what was that? Final Fantasy VII, Dirge of Cerberus. Remember that?
God, that game.
Yeah, it was kind of terrible. And Smith one pointed out that the reason it was terrible, instead of just being a typical 3D action game, they actually tried to make that like a 3D shooter. There's a control scheme for that where you can actually use the mouse and the keyboard on the PS2.
Really?
Yeah, it's.
Why?
Guy who made it. He liked his 3D shooters.
Yeah, it's just well, what's weird is every time I interview like mangaka or Japanese voice actors or Japanese directors or producers, and the topic of video games come up, they always mention Call of Duty and like Halo being their favorite games. So I wonder if it's just a perception that Japanese people don't like shooters.
Yeah, I think that's true to some extent, but the problem is there's already a giant, you know, Western market of developers pumping out those games, and if Japan tries to compete on that level with something like, I guess Vanquish would be a good example of a game that at least has the aesthetics of an American shooter. I don't know if you played that. That was kind of the new one from Sega and Platinum Games.
I think it came out the same day as Fallout, so I completely ignored it. And the rest of my life in order to play Fallout.
Yeah, and I think everybody did the same too, partly because it came out with Fallout, and because it really didn't look that different from the typical 3D shooter.
I had no idea it was even Japanese.
Yeah. It shows more in the gameplay than the actual designs, because you've got some interesting mechanics where it almost plays more like an action game, similar to Ninja Gaiden or Bayonetta than Gears of War.
Now, speaking of Bayonetta, that is one genre that I think the Japanese do have down pat, is that high action shoot, third person, I guess you could call it a shooter. I don't know. It's that Devil May Cry style of game. And Bayonetta, everybody points to Bayonetta as being like the best example. Like the most solidly, like, well-built, well-made example of that genre. And there is no one in the West that's really making games like that.
No, not really. The closest we come in the West are games that actually try to be Japanese in their look. There's Heavenly Sword.
Oh, God.
And
X-Blades.
And the developers for that made a new one called Enslaved, Journey to the West, which is actually based on the Monkey King legend. And it's got the same kind of shiny 3D faux anime style to it.
Yeah, yeah. I heard
it didn't do too well either. So
yeah, I heard mixed things about that. But it's stupid for them to release these things in the fall anyway. It's getting to the point where if you have a smaller game, you better put it out in the summer or in the spring, because people are just going to ignore the shit out of those games. One thing that I played through recently that should have been a Japanese game but wasn't was Castlevania: Lords of Shadow. Mm-hmm. I'm a big Castlevania fan. I love Castlevania. I've played pretty much every installment. I skipped some of the later DS titles because I just got tired of the Metroidvania thing, but it was really, really good. I really liked Lords of Shadow. It was really well made, and it was a competently put together God of War type clone. And I was curious to know, like, is that even, like, I couldn't see that game coming out of a Japanese developer.
It was made by, I believe the developer is Spanish, and you had actually Hideo Kojima, you know, the Metal Gear Solid guy who writes stories they can't shut up. He actually helped out with the development of that. So it was sort of a co-production a little bit.
Well,
and
the
thing about that is it didn't actually start out as a Castlevania game.
Yeah, no, that's very obvious. They just slapped the name Belmont on it and then said, no, this is Castlevania because there's a Belmont in it. You don't really fight Dracula. You fight the vampire lord and then a werewolf lord and then all this other shit. But it's a beautiful game. I thought it was really well made. I thought it was fun. It was long. It was like 20 hours. I think maybe we should start seeing more of that. Maybe the solution is to combine, you know, start doing co-productions, and then you'll revitalize the Japanese market a little bit. They can start learning from Western developers. Western developers can learn from Japanese developers. Maybe that's the future. Maybe that's the solution.
Yeah, that's definitely a good idea, I think, because Japan's game market is either going to really start catering more towards the dating simulator crowd, or they're going to have to evolve toward the West.
Yeah, which is kind of weird. I guess the whole perception that Japan was this dominant force is really just from the 80s.
And the early 90s, yeah.
And the 80s and the Super Nintendo era, yeah.
And a lot of it is because Nintendo's still around, and Nintendo, all their stuff is still successful, and it's still Japanese.
Yeah, totally.
Most of it's developed there.
So besides Costume Quest, have you been playing any of the super top-shelf AAA titles that are out this week, or this month, or this part of the year?
Well, I had Fist of the North Star and Sengoku Basara, Samurai Heroes.
Oh, yeah. We got a question about Sengoku Basara, so we'll get to that in a little bit. But how is Fist of the North Star? I was in Japan when that came out, and Akihabara was just plastered with signs for it everywhere. But
It's basically Dynasty Warriors with Fist of the North Star, where they basically took the Dynasty Warriors formula and added a lot more blood, exploding heads, stuff like that. And it really isn't that bad of a game. It's fun. It's got a lot of variety in the characters you can use, but the actual gameplay is just really kind of repetitive because you're fighting the same bunch of screaming, dying thugs over and over again. I think the quality of anime-based games has actually really gone up in the last decade because this Fist of North Star Ken's Rage game, it isn't great by any measure. It's enjoyable, but it's not really great. But it's also a million times better than the Fist of the North Star games that came out like in the 80s and the 90s.
So. Yeah, well, that's to be expected to evolve exactly. Somewhat from them. But I don't know. I've played it's true about those Dynasty Warriors games where if you played one, you've pretty much played every single one, right?
Yeah, and I think it's really the atmosphere of the Fist of the North Star game that really sets it apart.
Interesting, because I think AV Club gave it like a D-minus and just said
they ripped it apart. It's gotten savaged. I think it has like a 55 on Metacritic or something. That's a little harsh.
Well, yeah, but among anime fans, it got a good reception. Is it lowered expectations, or is it just, I like Fist of the North Star, therefore this game gets an automatic bump?
Pretty much that's a lot of what it is among anime fans.
Bias, okay.
Yes.
Well, it's out there, and it's good that it's out there, and people can buy it.
It's really not too bad of a game. I'd say rent it or wait till it drops in price a little bit.
Which it probably will very soon. That seems like it's bargain bin bound. For sure.
There is one thing about the Dynasty Warriors games. They are great little stress relief games because you get to like destroy stuff all over the place. And while it kind of fades within like 5 minutes of playing it, it works pretty well.
Unless you have to review it, and then you're stuck playing through the entire thing.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, so we got a bunch of Twitter questions. There's a million topics in here, so let's go ahead and get to these.
Okay.
All right, first up from Real Car, he sent in a bunch. He wants to know, why haven't the Full Metal Alchemist Brotherhood games or the Haruhi games been brought over?
Well, with Haruhi, I think that's obvious.
Yeah.
The show hasn't been as big of a hit as they thought it would be.
Mm.
With Full Metal Alchemist, it's kind of strange. You might know more about this than I do, but on Adult Swim, have they started showing the new Brotherhood episodes, or did they stop halfway through?
I believe it's done.
Oh, they finished it?
I believe they finished it on Adult Swim. I could be wrong about that, but I'm pretty sure that it concluded on Adult Swim.
Okay. Because I guess it just hasn't had the same impact that the original Full Metal Alchemist did, and that's to be expected.
Right. Well, it's the same basic thing for most of it, or at least for the first part.
Yeah.
That's clearly a case of they looked at the sales for the previous ones. They probably dropped off after a period of time and decided this isn't really worth localizing. And the show just didn't hit as big, so that seems pretty obvious to me.
It's for the same reason you haven't seen the Code Geass games over here or anything like that. We've actually, I think, fallen off in the Bleach games that have come over here. There are tons still getting released in Japan, but they've kind of slacked off on that a little bit in America.
The only thing that consistently gets put out are DBZ and Naruto. And Naruto's now being made by Western developers, right?
I believe, I think it was Ubisoft Montreal that made the Naruto game for the Xbox 360.
Well, they made a sequel to that, I'm pretty sure.
Rise of a Ninja, yeah.
Yeah, and they're still putting out the Ultimate Ninja Force, whatever the fuck.
Whatever it is, yeah.
I played, there was a demo of that on Xbox Live, and I tried it, and they're like, oh, it's cel-shaded, it looks exactly like the cartoon, it's, you know, now it's really aliased, so you can tell it's you're playing a cel-shaded video game. Also from Real Kari wants to know, if Love Plus was ever brought over, what do you think non-anime fans would say about it?
A lot of things that can't be printed, but yeah, that is a basic example of what goes through people's heads when they think of Japanese video games sometimes, just because of the overall, well, less because of the game itself, more because of what people are doing about the game. I mean, you saw the guy who married his Love Plus character.
Yeah, that was supposed to be performance art.
Something of a joke, yeah. But.
Performance art. Well, the thing with Love Plus, it's, to my knowledge, now I've never played these games, but to my knowledge, these are just, they're not games, they're girlfriend simulators, right?
Exactly.
So it's your pretend girlfriend, it's not really a game.
Mm-hmm.
Which, that, okay.
Stuff like that's been around since, I think, the late 1990s, where you just had a character simulation game.
Right.
But this, for some reason, has really caught on.
From Jimbo Slice, he wants to know, or he says, for Dynasty Warriors clone, Sengoku Basara is really enjoyable. Any thoughts or disagreement with my very poor taste?
And it's a pretty enjoyable game, although it does suffer, I think, from the same Dynasty Warriors curse of only being fun for like 20 minutes or so, and then it starts to sink in that the game's repeating itself.
Right. Yeah.
I'd be interested in seeing how well that game does over here, because you probably remember how the first game that they're in the Sengoku Basara series that they released here was called Devil Kings, and they basically completely boulderized it.
Yeah.
By making all the characters into fantasy or whatever heroes.
Yeah, I don't think it was very well received.
Yeah, and I think a lot of that, when I interviewed the guy who does Sengoku Basara, I think he said that they're also going to be looking at how the anime does over here when it comes to deciding on what new Samurai Heroes games they might release over here.
Well, the anime's been out for a little bit. I have no idea what the sales are like on it, but they actually did cross-promotion on that, so I was happy to see that. They were competent with the cross-promotion. So, I don't know. We'll see in about 6 months if they announce something else. Okay, from everybody's favorite, Evangelion V-Guy. He wants to know if it's good or bad that most visual novel games aren't released in the USA. Evangelion ones are crap. Damn you, Girlfriend of Steel. He says, because on one hand, visual novels are usually pretty bad, but on the other hand, maybe the companies could use the money. Well
if the companies, they could use the money to make more crappy visual novels, I guess. But I think it's generally a good thing, because most of those are just pandering nonsense. And there have been some interesting ones, I think. I'm honestly surprised that no one's really tried to do the Fate Stay novels officially.
Yeah, I think there's a tiny little market for it, and there's a niche publisher. There's a couple of niche publishers out there that are putting out visual novels. They don't do too many of them, and they're real limited in their production run. But
are you talking about the Anime Gamers, I think they're called?
Manga Gamer, I think they're called.
Manga Gamer, okay. I think most of their stuff is porn. So.
It is mostly porn, but that's what's going to sell. But I wouldn't be totally shocked if one day one of them decides, okay, we're gonna put out, you know, Clannad or whatever. Because there is a tiny little market for it. Unfortunately, this is another one of those things where the audience for that stuff, they already have it. It's been fan translated. They can get whatever they want.
That's exactly it. And most of the interesting visual novels aren't really the stuff that fans really want. They want, like you said, Clannad, and they're do you pronounce it canon or canon? I like saying it canon just because that might upset people, but
I don't care. Canon's fine.
But yeah, there actually are some critically acclaimed visual novels. I believe
most of the key stuff is.
Yeah, the name escapes me, but Chunsoft, the company that did Dragon Quest, they did a visual novel that actually got very good reviews, and it's supposedly a serious kind of novel, not really a pandering kind of thing. So I think at most you're going to see games that mix the visual novel style. There's one that's coming out, I think, next week called 9 Hours, 9 Persons, 9 Doors.
Yeah, and yeah.
It's kind of like the Professor Layton thing where you have a storyline interspersed with these logic puzzles.
Right.
So and I'd urge anybody who really wants to see more visual novels here to check that game out, because it's got a decent pedigree. It's by Chunsoft, and it has art by one of the Capcom, a former Capcom artist. So it's got some production standards behind it. So try that out. 9 Hours.
Yeah, I think the stuff that doesn't really have a chance here is where you're literally just clicking through a book. Like there has to be a game element to it. Otherwise, that's such a niche. That's such a tiny little niche. I don't see it making a splash or anybody really spending the money to release a product. And hey, if you want to talk about a one-two punch of industries with horrible piracy problems. Let's combine hardcore anime fandom with PC software.
Exactly. Yeah.
All right. Also from Real Car, he wants to know if there are any anime games worth importing. I remember when people used to do that all the time.
Yeah, people really got burned on a lot of those. I remember buying the Macross game for the Saturn back in the day, and that was an unbelievably boring piece of crap.
I'm sorry to hear that. Back in the day, back in the Dreamcast days, I imported the Berserk game, which was fun. And that was a good game to import because it's just a button masher.
Yeah, but then they turned it around and released it over here, though.
They did, but that was like a year later.
Yeah.
But I had released as Guts Fury or something like that.
Yeah, Guts is Rage.
Yeah.
Sword of the Berserk, that's what it's called.
There was...
Which they didn't do too bad a job translating it because they actually got some decent voice actors to dub the game. They had Michael Bell, who's really... famous cartoon voice actor.
Yeah.
He was Guts. But speaking of Fist of the North Star, actually, the PS2 Fighter, or the PS2 version of the Arc System Works Fist of the North Star fighting game, mm-hmm. is actually really good if you're into especially if you're into Fist of the North Star. It's a competent fighting game with some decent animation. And they go out of their way to recreate these scenes from the Fist of the North Star anime in the actual game itself. So that's one I would definitely suggest if you're into that. You can get it for about $30 now.
I'm kind of hoping that they put out at least a Wii version, if not a Move or Kinect version of the Castlevania motion game, arcade game.
The Whip game.
Yeah. I played it when I was there, and it was super fun. It had level up elements. It had all the RPG stuff in there. It was pretty complicated, and it was a lot of fun. I played it in Japan.
Oh, okay.
I was there the week it came out, and that was like number one on my list. Must play Castlevania arcade game. And it was super. It's totally made to be a Wii game. I don't know why I saw it out yet.
Haven't announced anything about it yet, which is kind of surprising. I guess the last Wii game that was in the Castlevania series, which was that awful Judgment fighting game.
Yeah. That was a nightmare. We all try to forget to pretend that one never happened. Okay, from Zeruda, he wants to. He wants to know how you feel that the Silent Hill movie director and writer won't be on board for the sequel/reboot. I guess he is presuming that you really care about the Silent Hill movie.
Yeah, which after seeing the first one, I don't really care too much, but you never know. What else has the new director done?
I have no idea. I don't know. I'm not really following it, which I don't know why, because I actually kind of liked the Silent Hill movie. I liked the last act anyway. I thought it was okay. It was close enough to the game, I guess. It wasn't a good movie, but, you know, it wasn't horrible like the second Resident Evil movie or most video game adaptations.
So, yeah, not too much to say about that.
Yeah. From Ben the Bear, he wants to know, would either of you want to see an Axis game based on anime? Do you think it would work well since the games are already anime-ish?
Yeah, they're kind of, well, they're not technically the American branch of Arc System Works, but they're pretty much doing all their games now.
Right.
And I'm sorry, did he ask for an anime version of that?
He basically wants to know if there are any franchises out there that could be turned into an Axis-style fighting game that haven't. I think did they do JoJo's? Or that was Capcom, right?
No, that was Capcom. They've only done Fist of the North Star because the guy who basically made Guilty Gear is a huge fan of that. And now they're making Arc System Works. They're making Blaze Blue now. That's where they're putting all their money. And that's really pretty much an anime without the license. It's got all the stereotypes and everything else. So,
yeah.
I don't know what else they would adapt, really.
Well, here's what I would like to see. I would like to see a full roster of every super cutesy moe girl and just turn it into a mega violent video game. Where you're playing one of the K-On! Chicks beating the shit out of one of the Clannad girls.
With death moves and everything.
There you go.
You get to rip someone's head off and winning.
Yes.
Yes.
Fatalities and all. That would probably be tremendously popular. I have no doubt that would be huge.
Honestly, I would almost like to see a game based on a fighting game based on Miyazaki movies.
Just because
it would be completely go against everything he stands for.
They'll have to wait till after he's dead, yeah.
He supposedly hates video games because back in the 1980s, someone made a Nausicaa video game, a licensed Nausicaa game, where you shoot the bugs.
Yeah. Oh, God.
Yeah.
So they missed the point, yeah. Nothing pisses Miyazaki off like you missing the point of his movies.
It's just a rumor, but supposedly that's why you haven't really seen any video games based on Ghibli or Miyazaki movies.
I'd like to see that game. That would be interesting. Okay, he also wants to know if Guilty Gear Blaze Blue would work better as a TV series or an OVA.
Yeah, there's based on all the past failures we've seen of fighting games becoming anime series, you really shouldn't want to see a Guilty Gear or Blaze Blue TV series.
Yeah. Well, I think they're threatening to do it at this point, right?
Yeah, maybe. Guilty Gear, they really hasn't had that much going on for it lately. And I think some of that, well, this is another rumor, but supposedly Sega and Sammy are feuding with Arc System Works over who owns the rights to it. So that's kind of why they moved on to BlazBlue. Anyway, though, Guilty Gear actually has a, I think, 5-minute promo clip they made. It's just constant fighting and horrible dubbing.
Mm-hmm.
And it's actually probably the best that you're going to see come out of a Guilty Gear anime. Because it's really well animated and unbelievably cheesy.
Yeah, I could never get behind those character designs. They're just too over the top for me.
Yeah, it's heavy metal mixed with anime, and I kind of like that. Because
it's neat.
And with BlazBlue, you basically just got the regular anime over the top stuff.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, Zero Intelligence wants to know if Persona counts as an anime video game or just a JRPG. It started as a JRPG and then it became an anime,
yeah.
So
mm-hmm.
I guess JRPG, right?
Yeah. And we now have the Persona anime out here, and I believe the Megami Tensei anime came out here as Tokyo Revelation back in the 1990s.
Yeah.
Which no one remembers because it was kind of terrible.
Yeah. okay, a bunch more from Real Car wants to know, why haven't the Death Note games been brought over? I did not know there were Death Note games.
Yeah, there are Death Note games, and it's not really the kind of license that lends itself well to video games.
Yeah, well, I mean, unless you're making an adventure game.
Mm-hmm.
Where you know the ending.
Exactly.
I it would be kind of neat if they made it so that it had like a bunch of different endings where you could change the fate of the characters and stuff. That would be neat. But maybe that exists. I don't know. Okay. Also from Real Kari, what's with the Charles Schulz Peanuts video games that were only in Japan?
Yeah, the ones that Square Enix made.
Yeah, I didn't. What are these? I don't know what these are.
Well, I think Namco actually had the rights to one of them. They released a Snoopy game. I'm not sure what actually happened to keep them in Japan only. But that's happened before with some games where the license just couldn't be worked out for an American release. There's even back in the days of the old Nintendo, there were games based on Labyrinth that only came out in Japan.
Mm-hmm.
There's for some reason, there's a – you remember Iron Eagle 3?
Yes.
The Iron Eagle movies? There's a Famicom game based on that that never came out in America.
Really?
So it happens sometimes, though, where you see a game based on an American property. I think there's a Die Hard game for the Saturn.
Yeah, well, that's not Die Hard Arcade, right?
No, it's an actual Die Hard game based on Die Hard.
Huh, interesting. Didn't know about that. Yeah, I played that Capcom Labyrinth game. There's a fan translation out there. It's pretty shitty. It's not very good. Okay, next up he wants to know, why haven't the Toho games been sold officially in English?
That's another thing where I guess that's because Death Smiles hasn't sold too well yet. That's another thing where you have a really dedicated fan following that's basically stolen the games already, so...
What the hell is Toho?
Started off as this series of shooting games that started these cutesy anime girls. There's a witch, there's a priestess, and the fans just took it and went nuts with it. They made all this fan-made stuff, fan art, internet catchphrases.
Right. It was a meme, really. It caught on as a meme.
Yeah, basically.
And do you think
it's kind of like Hatsune Miku, I guess.
Interesting, yeah.
But the people who made it never really expected it to get quite so insane.
You think it has a shot at all of getting licensed, or does it matter? Does it just completely rely on sales of the current existing bullet hell Japanese shooters?
Well, they're very simple shooters, at least at first they were. So I can't see a company taking a chance on that. Although, I don't know if you saw Reseteer, that game that came out.
Yeah.
That was a doujin game, basically an independent game.
Yeah.
So there's still a chance.
Well, that item shop Reseteer thing, I was under the impression that it was doing okay, like surprisingly well.
Actually,
enough.
Yeah, it did do really that one did do really well, possibly because not a lot of people had heard of it before it got translated.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Chard Knight wants to know, do you think the FMA games would be better if Square Enix did it themselves, or would it be like Final Fantasy 14 and be worse?
I think they really haven't chosen the genres right on that one, because they used an RPG, I think, for the first few that came out here. When the thing about FMA is you've really got this kinetic style to the battles where they're turning everything into weapons, they're throwing all these alchemic spells at each other. So it lends itself better to a fighting game or to a Bayonetta-style action game.
Yeah, I mean, I played the PS2 games and they were pretty lackluster. Like,
yeah.
Sort of generic action RPGs.
Which I think people are interested in because of in the Brotherhood games, because there's a new PSP game that's basically a 2-on-2 fighter. And that might work out better, but like we said earlier, you're probably not going to see that in America anytime soon.
Yeah, interesting. Okay, well, that about does it. Thanks a lot for joining us and coming on and chatting games. We never really get to do that on this show, and I'm a fan. So, all right, dude, thanks a lot.
Hey, sure.
All right, that's our show. I want to thank everyone for joining me. Don't forget to subscribe to us on iTunes, and hey, we will see you all next week.